Today on Pilot's Discretion, we're joined by author and pilot John Lancaster. He tells us about a mostly forgotten cross-country air race in 1919, flying the same route in his LSA, and life as a foreign correspondent. Pilot's Discretion starts right now. Welcome, pilots. I'm your host, John Zimmerman of Sporties, and thanks for listening. If you like Pilot's Discretion, there are three things to know. First, you can catch up on every previous episode by visiting sporties.com/podcast. Second, you can subscribe and leave a review in your favorite podcast app to help other pilots find the show. And third, you can always send your comments to podcast@sporties.com. Today, our guest is John Lancaster, a journalist who has written for the Washington Post and National Geographic, among many other outlets. And he has just released a wonderful new book called The Great Air Race, Glory, Tragedy, and the Dawn of American Aviation. This tells the story of some pioneering pilots who charted a course across America in 1919, and it's a route he flew himself in a flight design CTLS while researching the book. John, welcome to Pilot's Discretion.
Well, thank you for having me, John.
Like many listeners of this podcast, I'm a big fan of aviation history, so I was surprised reading the book that I'd never heard of this event. Can you tell us briefly what the air race was all about?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. I mean, and I should say you're not the only one who's never heard of it. I'd never heard of it either when I first ran across a reference to it. And, when I was pitching the book with an agent to a New York publisher a few years ago, first question out of the editor's mouth was, how come I've never heard of this? So it's not something that's well known in the present day, although it was a huge deal at the time. And for good reason. It was a spectacular event. This was a coast-to-coast transcontinental air race, started two groups of pilots, 63 total. One group, the largest group, starting in Long Island at Roosevelt Field, which was an Army Air Service base. We're talking about, you know, the immediate aftermath of World War I here. And the smaller group of 15 pilots took off from the Presidio in San Francisco, which was also an Army installation. And the idea was that they would race from coast to coast. And once they reached the opposite coast, they would turn around and go back the other direction. It was a round trip race of about 5,400 miles. And they were flying surplus World War I airplanes, which of course weren't suited to this sort of thing. They'd never been designed for it. And it was basically a publicity stunt. It was an effort by Brigadier General Billy Mitchell, considered the father of the U.S. Air Force, and at the time, a decorated war hero who oversaw U.S. air combat operations on the Western Front. He conceived this race basically to build congressional and public support for aviation in the aftermath of the war. He understood that it was a game-changing technology. He wanted people to pay attention, and he did get their attention, although not always in the way that he perhaps would have liked.
Yeah, you hint at it there, but it's staggering statistics. 9 people died during this race. 54 airplanes crashed, by my math. So, did it work? I mean, given those numbers, the race was completed. But would you say it was successful? Did it prove aviation was the future? Could be reliable, or did it give aviation a black eye?
Well, it's a complicated, nuanced answer. There's not a simple answer to that question. I would say, in terms of Mitchell's political objectives, which was his immediate concern, he had staged the race, as I said, to build support for aviation, which in practical terms meant budgetary support from the federal government, and all because the country was demobilizing and there wasn't much appetite for spending money on new airplanes. And Mitchell knew they needed money to keep the industry afloat. There was no commercial market at that time. And then another objective, a main objective of his was he wanted Congress to approve an independent Air Force, probably with him running it, but he didn't say so openly. But that was his crusade that really defined his post-war career. And in that sense, he really failed on both counts. I mean, the Air Service continued to demobilize after the race, and he never achieved in his lifetime an independent Air Force. He died in 1936. It wasn't until 1947 that the Air Force was created. And interestingly, the first chief of staff was General Carl Toohey Spatz, who was a contestant in the 1919 air race. He flew in the contest. But that was on the sort of failure side of the ledger. But I think in some sense you can say it was a success It certainly didn't demonstrate the reliability of airplanes. I mean, as you said, there were 54 crashes, 9 fatalities. 2 of those fatalities, incidentally, just if I can digress for a second, occurred even before the race started. It was 2 pilots flying to the start of the race in Long Island. So pretty high mortality rate when you consider there were just 63 aircraft involved in this thing. So there was a lot of editorial criticism of the race. You know, this came after a conflict that had claimed more than 100,000 young American lives. A lot of editorial writers were, questioned openly, what was the point of sacrificing these young men, to a sort of dubious cause in peacetime, when the country had already endured so much sacrifice. So that was something that obviously Mitchell was not seeking in orchestrating this race. But in terms of getting the public's attention, in terms of generating broad enthusiasm for aviation, I think you can say it absolutely succeeded. I mean, the country was riveted by this. Bear in mind that at that point in American aviation history, airplanes had begun to prove their worth on the battlefield in Europe, but there was really very few civilian applications. The only people who bought airplanes in 1919 were rich guys, with too much time and money on their hands. The veterans who bought surplus Curtis Jennies for $300 and barnstormed around the country giving rides and doing loops at county fairs. But there was no commercial air service at all. And all this was highly speculative and people were quite skeptical of the airplane. And then all of a sudden you had this great spectacle of dozens of airplanes flying across the country, landing at these improvised airfields and making it to the coasts in many cases. They were riveted. The public was riveted. The New York Times carried 30 stories on this contest in the course of a few weeks. 8 of them were on the front page, and that's just one newspaper. I mean, it was really, you can say, it was certainly one of the 2 or 3 dominant stories of the period. The World Series was also going on when it started. That was another one. But it was a big deal. And after the contest, there were a lot of naysayers, but there were also perhaps an equal or even greater number of people who said, this really does sort of suggest the practical possibilities of air travel. And there were editorials written to that effect. In spite of the losses, it did not take a great leap of imagination to see that where this was going, that they would solve these technical problems, that airfields would be improved, that instruments would be improved, that radios would soon be widely adopted. It just the transcontinental air race sort of made it clear what was coming for all its flaws.
Give us a sense of just how ambitious or even possibly foolish this idea was. You mentioned 5,400 miles. This is at a time when airplanes barely flew, 150 miles? What would be a modern equivalent of this type of race? It seems staggering. This was obviously before Lindbergh. This is before even airmail, before, trimotors ferrying passengers. I mean, how ambitious was this idea?
Well, as you say, given the technology of the time, it was wildly ambitious and even borderline foolish, as you suggested. And I think, given the death toll, there's a plausible argument to be made that it was foolish. But these were planes. This was a motley collection of World War I airplanes. The Air Service just scratched together whatever it had. There were some single seat Scouts. Most of the planes were de Havilland. Or DH-4s, actually made by an American company based on a British design. It was the only American combat aircraft that saw service on the Western Front during the war, because the United States was sort of late to the party in that regard. And so a lot of the best designs, all the best designs really were British, French, or Italian. There were single seat Scouts like SE-5s, and there was also a handful of captured German Fokker D-7s, which was widely considered the most capable fighter of the war. But the point is, these were warplanes. They were not built to go long distances. They were built, to fly on the Western Front. And so the DH-4 had a range of maybe 3 hours, the others, the Fokker, somewhat less. As a consequence, they had to design the route in a way to accommodate the limitations of these airplanes. So they had refueling stops that they called control stops roughly every 200 miles. There were about 20 of them. I mean, it varied anywhere from between, say, 60 miles and 250 miles. And in the latter case, that would be sort of at the outer limits of their range. And So that's one thing. They just, the technology was just not really quite ready for prime time. And then, of course, they had no radios. Radios had been introduced towards the end of the war and were starting to be used on the Western Front, but they were not used at all in this race. The planes were not equipped with radios. So there was no communication with the ground. They couldn't get word if you know, the weather had closed in at a destination airfield, for example. And instrumentation was certainly not suited to flying in bad weather. They basically had an altimeter and an airspeed indicator, maybe what's called a bubble indicator, which was sort of like a carpenter's level that would serve as a bank indicator of sorts. But if they flew into bad weather, which of course they did all the time, and which accounted for a number of fatalities, they relied on the old seat of the pants techniques, basically the pressure of the seat on their posteriors, and that's how they could tell whether they were slipping or skidding, and obviously that has its limitations in low visibility conditions, and then there was just the infrastructure itself. You asked about how ambitious this was. Well, they basically had to create an entire transcontinental airway out of nothing. There were, by my count, let's see, maybe, well, there was, of course, the field at Roosevelt Field in Long Island was well established. There was one at the Presidio. There were a couple sort of airfields along the way. There was a U.S. Airmail had just gotten started, and there was a airmail field in Bryan, Ohio. But for the most part, they just winged it. They literally, like with a week or so before the race, and in some cases just a few days before the race, you know, Billy Mitchell sent his officers out along the route, and they just would go, and they would go out with the mayor or some other town official, and they'd sort of scout the terrain and say, well, you know, will Farmer Joe, you know, will he make his field or pasture available for us? And they negotiated deals on the spot, and they marked it with limestone with a big circle and a numerical identifier, so pilots would have an idea of where they were landing. Then, of course, they had to supply it with fuel and spare parts, each airfield, and some sort of communications infrastructure. So in that case, maybe that meant running a telegraph line out or a telephone line out to the field from the town. The one thing they did that made it doable was they chose as their route basically the path of the Union Pacific Railroad, at least west of Chicago. And so this obviously made it much easier to supply these fields with supplies, because the fields were all located in towns situated on the railroad. In fact, they in many cases existed only because of the railroad. Even so, it was a crazy improvised thing. I mean, literally one of the fields in Green River, Wyoming, it snowed a day or two before the race. And there was like a foot of snow on the field. It hadn't been prepared at all. And they had to skip it for the first few days, just so the air service officer assigned to the Green River could, you know, round up 20 horse teams and a bunch of local volunteers to clear the sagebrush once the snow had melted. I mean, it was that kind of thing.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. Really, my favorite part of the book in some ways is the description of those airfields, if you even want to call them that, and development of that. Many of them, though, live on today in some form, at least. I mean, some of the cities involved would be recognizable to any pilot flying across the country. So you can kind of see the mark from this in many places even today.
You can. Of course, they don't look anything like they did in 1919. I mean, there are a few that can definitely trace their pedigree to the Transcontinental Race. One is a Britton Field in Rochester, New York. That's now Rochester's International Airport, which is served by some major carriers. Another one in the Quad Cities at Rock Island, Illinois, which serves the Quad Cities area of Illinois and Iowa, and maybe one or two others. But for the most part, of course, you know, there's nothing left of the contest.
It's interesting reading about air races and what an essential part of pop culture, even much beyond aviation, in those early days was. And I thought it was interesting, just a few weeks ago, the National Aeronautic Association announced it's going to host a four-day, 1,000-mile air race for electric aircraft this time, sort of trying to recapture some of that sense of early aviation days. Why do you think those early air races were so important? And do you think an event like that can still work in the 21st century?
Well, there's a lot more stuff competing for our attention now, obviously. Nobody had a smartphone in 1919. Nobody was on TikTok. So I think in some ways the country was, you know, there was more sort of the country could focus its collective attention on things the way that it perhaps doesn't in a much more fragmented age. So I had not actually heard of the electric air race. And my first thought was that's going to be a long extension cord. But I for one will certainly pay attention to that. I find it fascinating that's being attempted. I think this age has passed. I mean, for one thing, you know, aviation was still so new. I mean, it was in 1919, that was only 16 years after the Wright brothers at Kitty Hawk. You know, I mean, this was a brand new technology. People really had no idea, how it was going to evolve. I mean, they could speculate, but it was very much in its early stages. And so I think, you know, it had a novelty value that the airplane just lacks today, that pretty much anything lacks today. So in that sense, I think it was kind of unique to the times.
John, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to ask you about flying the route.
Earn your pilot's license, get current, or add a rating. No matter what your goal is, Sporty's pilot training app will save you time and money. It's available on all your devices, including iPad, iPhone, Android, and smart TVs, so you can access Sporty's award-winning courses anywhere. Plus, with automatic sync between platforms and free lifetime updates, you'll always be current. Over 25 courses are available, from private pilot to aerobatics. Visit sporties.com/discover for a free trial. Now, back to Pilot's Discretion.
We're back with John Lancaster, who not only wrote a book about this transcontinental air race, but he also flew it himself in a light sport aircraft, which sounds like a great way to research a book. So, John, what was most surprising about that, or what did you learn on that trip that really opened your eyes?
Well, I learned that my wife is exceedingly tolerant because I have to say, when I first conceived this book, I thought, you know, if I really want to do it right, I ought to, you know, do it right. And that meant flying the route. But I thought this is going to be a tough sell at home. So you can imagine the conversation with my wife when I explained that I had this great book idea. And oh, by the way, I needed to buy an airplane and fly across the country and back, even though I hadn't flown in almost 40 years. I should mention, I did get my pilot's license in 1980, but it obviously had not seen any use since about 1981 or 82. So it took some retraining. It just seemed it would lend a, it would add a dimension to the book that would otherwise be missing. I wanted to be able to describe, you know, what the Medicine Bow Mountains looked like. You know, what the sort of Utah salt flats looked like. And it seemed like it would give the book a dimension that it wouldn't have if I just had relied on Google Earth or whatever. And it was also really fun. I mean, I'll just be honest. I mean, it was the adventure of a lifetime. It was a challenge. I mean, I had at the time, I think if you count the maybe 100 hours I'd accumulated in the early 80s, I maybe added another 100 hours of flying, you know, before I actually attempted this flight. So I was a 200-hour pilot, you know, needless to say, I was not instrument rated. And of course, LSAs aren't instrument certified anyway. I was feeling fairly confident. I'd taken some fairly long training flights, including one to the Bahamas, with someone who actually knew what he was doing and could show me how my avionics worked. By the time I took off, I had actually been flying quite a bit and I was fairly confident, and it turned out to be really fun.
Yeah, that's one of the all-time spouse stories. I think we've all in aviation had to do various sales jobs over the years about why we really need that new headset or maybe some new avionics, but that's a great one. I'm writing a book and I can't do it without buying an airplane. I'll remember that one.
Yeah. Well, just to be clear, she saw through me instantly, but she let me do it anyway. So I'm in her debt.
You obviously had a ton of tools that the pilots of 100 years ago did not. What do you think actually made the biggest difference? Is it reliable engine, data link weather, GPS, air traffic control. What did you have that was most helpful that those pioneers didn't have?
Gosh, well, it's hard to say because it's obviously there's been such a revolution in technology and really just a revolution in the last 20 or so years with the digital revolution and the glass panel, which I had a full glass panel on my LSA. There's just so much. I mean, obviously, a reliable engine is a good starting point. You're not getting very far without one of those. But I would say the thing that I was just kind of took so much of the stress and guesswork out of this was the GPS. I mean, that single technology. I mean, just being able to sort of punch in the airport code and then, you know, follow the magenta line. And then, of course, then set the autopilot. I mean, you know, you don't want to say it's idiot proof because there's still plenty of ways to get in trouble, even in a modern airplane. And there are times you have to exercise your judgment. And, you know, of course, you actually have to, you know, enter the pattern and keep your eyes open and land the thing. So you still have to fly the plane. But I did feel a lot of the time that this is cheating. This is just cheating. it's not fair. And the other thing that struck me was just being in an enclosed cockpit, right? With a noise canceling headset on. I mean, these guys were in open cockpits, and these were unmuffled engines. The DH4 had a 12 cylinder, 400 horsepower Liberty engine. I mean, just imagine. And these guys would literally be deaf for 20 minutes when they got on the ground. There were many times that I, gave thanks for the fact that I had a modern airplane.
I feel like many pilots, or at least some pilots, are scared of such a long cross-country flight. But in my experience, those long, long trips can be the most rewarding part of flying. As you mentioned, they can be somewhat stressful. There's some work, but I think they're life-changing sometimes. So what's your advice for somebody who's maybe considering one of these long trips, especially in an LSA or a smaller airplane? What's your advice for somebody thinking about a trip like that?
Well, first of all, I'd say do it. You know, I mean, it was a great experience. And I think that, you know, you have to basically think about it as not one long trip, but as a series of very small trips. You know, I mean, say, first of all, don't be in a hurry. You know, give yourself an open-ended schedule. So if you get stuck in Rochester, New York by bad weather for 2 or 3 days, like I did, it's no big deal. Wait for good weather to cross, you know, major mountain ranges for obvious reasons, which I did that as well. But, you know, if you break it into bite-sized pieces, I mean, I was actually doing some research at some of these towns along the way. I'd stop in a local library or historical society or whatever. Sometimes there were newspapers and other materials that they had that were not available online. So I kind of had an excuse to spend a few days in each place. But I would say, you know, don't be in a hurry. And just think of it as a series of small flights. Like, you know, my first day, I flew from Roosevelt Field can't fly from Roosevelt Field since it's now a shopping mall, but at Republic Airport on Long Island to Binghamton, New York, which was the first stop in the race. And then I ended my day at the second stop in the race, which was Rochester, where I had to do some research. I mean, that was, you know, what was that? Maybe 3 hours of flying total. I can't remember, but it wasn't like a terribly long day of flying. I don't think there were any days. Except when I on the way back, I saw no point in kind of landing at some of the places I'd landed going out. So I did have some longer flying days on the way back. But for the most part, I never flew any more than 3 or 4 hours in a day. And of course, I would, you know, land every couple of hours regardless. So again, if you think of it as sort of, a series of short flights, it seems much less daunting and it's totally doable. And, I'm sitting here to tell you that. So.
A few questions about your previous life as a foreign correspondent before we get to our Ready to Copy segment. First, I'm always curious about skills that translate from other parts of life to flying. So any skills that you used as a foreign correspondent that are valuable as a pilot?
Well, in some ways, I guess I hadn't ever really thought about that. It's an interesting question. I think to be a successful foreign correspondent, you have to be, I would say, open to adventure, certainly. So I think that's applies to flying. You have to be, I think, sort of organized and focused. I mean, you have to, if you're dropping into an unfamiliar city for the first time in South Asia or the Middle East, like I did you know, too many times to count. I mean, you have to be very organized about what, where you're going, what your objectives are. So there's a lot of planning involved. There's a lot of prep work involved before you even get on the plane to where you're going. So there's some parallels there, I would say. I would say the difference, of course, is that there's not really a technological aspect to being a foreign correspondent. I mean, certainly you have to master the basics of getting your stories back to Washington. In my case, I work for the Washington Post. But, you know, in the age of the internet, that's not very hard. There are some parallels. Mostly they're just both really fun.
You're in New Delhi for one of your postings, I know. So what's something most Americans get wrong about India that you learned from your time there?
Oh, gosh, another interesting question that I hadn't thought about. What most Americans get wrong about India? Well, I would say that, you know, this is actually a little dated. I got to India in 2002, I wouldn't say at the dawn of the tech age, but fairly early in the technology age when the sort of whole outsourcing boom was just taking off. Those companies had been gestating for a while, but it really exploded during my time there. And I think most Americans now understand that India is actually a hub of technology expertise and activity. At the time, that wasn't the case. I think a lot of people still had sort of an outdated view of India as this kind of antiquated, creaky, not very efficient democracy, which is still true in a lot of ways. But there's also a very sort of 21st century side to the place I think people are surprised by, especially if you go to one of the tech centers like Bangalore or Chennai or something like that. So I'd say that's probably the one that comes immediately to mind.
Okay, John, we always close these podcast episodes with something we call Ready to Copy. I'll throw out some questions on a wide variety of topics and you give me your quick answer. Are you ready to copy?
Ready to copy.
Your book showed to me the essential role the military has played in aviation development. We think about World War II, but World War I, you quote how from 1917 to 1918, airplane production increased 18-fold and we trained 10,000 pilots. So is it an exaggeration to say that American aviation exists because of the military?
Not really. Not really. I mean, certainly in terms of the sort of government's involvement, that really started with the military. The government has invested, you know, billions over the last century in aeronautics and aircraft development and the technology that powers the industry. So, I mean, there have been other factors, too. There's now a sort of commercial imperative that didn't exist in 1919. But certainly in the early days, you have to say that the military was the driving force between a lot of the aviation development we saw in this country.
Reading your book, there's lots of common themes with today, especially about weather and get there-itis. So do you think aviation's continuing problem with VFR flight into IMC is somehow rooted in that early airmail pilot's mindset of deliver the mail no matter what the weather? Do you think that lives on today to some extent?
I think it lives on today, but I think it's rooted more in just human nature. You know, I think people are just are impatient and they talk themselves into doing things that they probably, you know in some part of their mind that they shouldn't be attempting. I mean, we see it happen all the time, as you suggest. So in that sense, there's a lot about flying that hasn't changed, because certainly a lot of the fatalities in the race were caused by pilots who were just a little bit impatient and perhaps a little bit overconfident.
What's your favorite anecdote from the book? An incredible story or fact? I know I've got three or four, but I'm interested in if there's one that stands out to you.
Well, as you say, there's several. It's sort of like choosing among your children. But the one that comes immediately to mind is Belvin Maynard, the Baptist preacher turned Air Service lieutenant, who I don't want to give away any major plot points, but he's a major figure in the race. And at one point, he was flying over Nebraska, and his engine, the crankshaft broke, and he made a forced landing in a cornfield. And he and his mechanic thought they were out of the race, but then they got word that there was that one of the other aircraft, also with the same kind of engine, had crashed just a few miles away. And so they got permission from headquarters to remove one of the engines. And under the race rules, they had to be on their way again within, I can't remember whether it was 24 or 48 hours. It's in the book, but I've forgotten. But anyway, they had a very short period of time. I believe it was just 24 hours. They had to change out the engine overnight by the light of headlamps from farmers' trucks and a portable lighting system. So if you can imagine, they had to unship the engine from the crashed Martin bomber, put it on a flatbed, drive it 40 miles, I believe, to this field where it was. And the mechanic and a helper managed to get this thing installed between sunset and sunrise, and they were on their way again the next morning.
Yeah, that's an absolutely unbelievable story. That was on my list. The other one I liked was the pilot who got knocked unconscious because the ice from the radiator flew off and hit him in the head. So that's, to your point about an enclosed cockpit, not something we have to worry about today.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
Do you have a favorite airport you visited along the air race route, or a favorite stop or site?
That's an interesting question, too. I just have to pause for a moment. I mean, there were several. Oh, I do have a favorite. I do have a favorite. Sydney, Nebraska. It was a stop on the race, the last stop if you're heading west before Cheyenne, Wyoming, on the western edge of Nebraska. And I mean, maybe it's my favorite just because I remember the landing so vividly, because it was right at the edge of my crosswind capability. It's gusting up to like 24 knots at, you know, I don't know, not quite 90 degrees off the runway, but it was a kind of a hairy landing. I actually had to go around and then land again. And I just remember being so happy to be there. And then I landed. It was outside of town, right on the prairie. It was one paved runway, and then I believe it had a grass strip running in another direction. And I taxied with difficulty because it was so windy. And I taxied up to the ramp, and there was just no one around. And I was kind of freaking out because, like, where do I tie down my plane? Where do I get fuel? And I mean, it was just deserted. And then after about 10 minutes, this guy came out kind of embarrassed, who was the local airport manager. And I'd actually called the phone number for the airport, and he hadn't answered. And he came out very apologetically. He'd been working on his plane in a hangar and hadn't heard it. And he just was the nicest guy, and let me keep my plane in the hangar overnight. I'm not even sure he charged me, or if he did, it was almost nothing. And we just had a great chat about my trip and aviation. And he had a 172, I believe, that he was a fairly young guy. And I just remember that very fondly as a really hospitable airport manager in a part of the country that I had never been and knew nothing about.
That's that great GA spirit. Love to hear those stories. This is your first book, so I'm curious what you think the biggest myth is about the book publishing business.
Oh, gosh, that's a good one. What's the biggest myth? let's see. I guess I can only look at it from the perspective of, that's an easy one, actually, now that I think about it. And again, this is just from, I published one book, but this is my own perspective. There's the rap on the book industry these days is that books don't get edited. And frankly, if you read a lot of books, you do see a lot of errors in there, a lot of typos that I don't remember seeing 20 or 30 years ago. And I think it is true that the publishers, you know, they operate with thin profit margins and have pared back somewhat on their editing staff. Having said that, I had a great editor, he was just a really thoughtful guy. He improved the book in all kinds of ways without, you know, in any way sort of changing its spirit or structure or anything really that I was wedded to. So I would say that, at least in the case of my publisher, which was Liverite, which is part of W.W. Norton, which is a major publisher that people have probably heard of, at least at Liverite, public editing lives on, so in that sense, I would say it's a myth that books don't get edited anymore. Mine certainly was, and edited well.
You reported from Cairo for the Washington Post for many years. So what's your favorite Middle Eastern food that all pilots need to try that we may not have heard of?
Well, my mind immediately goes to Beirut, because I went to Beirut at the drop of a hat, didn't need any excuse to go to Beirut. I came up with all kinds of flimsy story ideas to get myself to Lebanon, because as a friend of mine said, it's impossible to eat a bad meal in Lebanon. And it's really true. But I guess if I had to pick one favorite food, I'd say just the shawarma they serve off the street in Beirut is just, it's as good as anything you'll get in a fancy restaurant in New York or Washington or anywhere else. That sticks in my mind.
Our last question is always the same. You have one final flight. We want to know, what are you flying and where are you going?
Well, I should say I am. I sold my plane last year, sadly, I miss it every day. So that's the only plane I ever wanted to own, at least in this phase of my life. And it's the only plane I'd ever want to own if I got another one. It was perfect for my needs. I loved it. So I would get the exact same plane that I had. I might want to try flying back to the Bahamas this time by myself, because I just remember that as a magical trip. You know, a little bit of excitement. You're flying over a couple hundred miles of open water in a single engine plane. That's something that keeps your mind focused. And it's also just breathtakingly beautiful to see those, you know, sand formations around the islands in the Bahamas and to come in over the, you know, sparkling waters to land at Eleuthera as I did. You know, I would take the same trip in the same plane. And I know that's not very imaginative, but that's my honest answer.
John, thanks for being on the podcast.
Great talking to you, John. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to Pilot's Discretion, brought to you by Sporties, training and equipping pilots worldwide for over 60 years. For more episodes and today's show links, visit sporties.com/podcast. I'm John Zimmerman. We'll see you next time on Pilot's Discretion.